Hello, hello, hello. It's been a long time, hasn't it? I've been doing a lot of things. Gotten to theater, a musical, in fact, and reading one of Leonard Schlein's other books titled "Sex, Power, and Time." Just finished it, actually. Ooh, what a great read! And I just bought one of his other books, Leonardo's Brain, or something of that nature. This author is incredible. I just wanted to share that with you. But I know you come here for me reading. Well, we've gotten to chapter 6, so maybe I should just get on with it. And hopefully, since I've been listening to a lot of podcasts and practicing more mindful speech and reading, this might be better. Also, excuse me, I have the sniffles. So, just excuse my bodily fluids moving around my face. If you can accept that, you can accept everything. All right, chapter 6, page 69. Hey-o! Quote by Leonardo da Vinci. Won't you look at that? Art is the queen of all sciences, communicating knowledge to all the generations of the world. Quote Isaac Newton. We are to admit no more causes of natural things than such are both true and sufficient to explain their appearances. Okay, chapter 6. Artist, scientist, slash mystic, physicist. If Giotto loomed great upon the threshold of the Renaissance, Newton was the giant who closed the door upon this era. Imperious and brilliant, he was endowed with a mind as incisive as a cut glass. He made sweeping discoveries about gravity, motion, and light, gathering up the beams and struts of his and earlier scientific discoveries. He constructed a seemingly impregnable citadel of thought. What began in the early Renaissance as a quickening in the understanding of nature culminated in 1687, when Newton published his all-encompassing Principia Mathematica, the Bible of the new scientific paradigm. Newton, continuing a theme begun by Descartes and Galileo, demoted God to the role of grand designer. In the scientific determinism that grew out of Newton's insights, there could be no more room for miracles. God ceased to be an active participant in the daily affairs of his subjects and became a passive observer of the creation he had set into motion. Newton began with the Pythagorean assumption that nature can be reduced to mathematical relationships. He was so taken with Euclid's organization of the elements of geometry that he used a similar format, starting with definitions and proceeding to formulate his laws upon them. In doing so, he scaffolded upon Aristotelian logic, and then added Galileo's experimental method, always checking theory with observed facts, and concluded with his own revelations concerning mechanics, gravitation, and the infinitesimal calculus. Newton presented his insight in the language of mathematics. Crisp equations and numbers translated the mighty wheelings of the heavens, crowding them into thin pages of paper. The system of thought, a thorough and practical method for investigating and describing the physical phenomena of the world, became known as Newton's classical mechanics. It worked magnificently. His intellectual feat so astonished by his countrymen that he was compared to Moses come down from Mount Sinai. Alexander Pope summed up the feeling of the sage when he wrote, quote, "Nature and nature's laws lay hid in night. God said, let Newton be, and all was light." Classical mechanics addressed objective reality. Space and time were a tight intersecting grid where the events of science took place. The investigator, like God, usually sat motionless and observed the external world. During the rise of Newton's system, Western European art had also been concerned with the concrete objects of the external world. Perspective distinctly separated the I from the it, just as perspective was a framework that allowed painters to carry out what the 19th-century English painter John Constable later called experiments on nature. So Newton's system was to be a map that made possible an exploration to the edge and beyond. Art and physics each concurred with common sense, which further enhanced their popular acceptance. The laws of physics enabled the knowledgeable user to draw diagrams of trajectories of missiles and orbits of planets. These diagrams connected individual objects with imaginary lines that could not be seen in nature. In art, beneath the paint of the canvas, there also lay hidden the pentimenti of the invisible lines the artist had drawn while planning the painting. The dominant perspectivist convention ruled over art from the 1300s to the 1860s. Classical physics reigned from approximately 1500 to 1900. During these centuries, the parallel principles of perspective and Newtonian physics permeated every aspect of European civilization. Despite many brilliant accomplishments of this genius, Newton put into place... Pause. Resume. I don't know where I stopped before that phone call, but this is what happens when you read at work. But it's okay. Let's see. Despite the many brilliant accomplishments of this genius, Newton put into place a series of flawed notions regarding the essence of relationships among space, time, and light. Galileo's idea of rest within an inertial frame of reference became the starting point of Newton's system. In Hypothesis 1 of the System of the World, Newton states, quote, "The center of the system of the world is unmovable. This is acknowledged by all, while some contend that the Earth, others that the Sun, is fixed in that center." End quote. Newton accepted Galileo's theory of relativity and at first sought a point in space near the Sun that would be at absolute rest. He tried to calculate its position by taking into account the gravitational fields of all the planets, moons, and sun. What would subsequently influence Newton's ideas on the subject of absolute rest were two related discoveries. In 1676, Ole Christensen Roemer, a Danish astronomer, demonstrated that light traveled across space at a finite speed. When apprised of this information, Newton, like other scientists, asked an obvious question. What yardstick can the speed of light be measured against if, according to Galileo, every object in the sky is in motion relative to all the other objects? The second was Christian Huygens' 1678 proposal that light traveled through space as a wave transmitted by an invisible substance called the luminiferous ether. Although Newton disagreed with this assessment, he believed light was corpuscular, made up of tiny particles that shot through space in straight, single-file rays. He accepted the idea of an invisible, insensate ether because he could conveniently use the ether to convey his newly discovered gravitation, as well as answer the question raised by Roemer's calculation of the speed of light. The monumentous mistake that Newton made regarding the ether was to assign it to the property of absolute rest. He believed that while the fixed stars, sun, planets, and moon executed the choreographic steps in the stately ballet, the ether provided the platform that was superior to all other viewing platforms. A stationary observer parked anywhere in the ether had a privileged vantage point that remained at all times at absolute rest. From this, beeping everywhere. From this followed Newton's conception of space and time. Newton carved in stone the absolute immutability of both his words, rolling off the mountaintop in sonorous tones, were spoken with the stentorian authority of scientific God. Quote, "Absolute, true, and mathematical time of itself and from its own nature flows equably without regard to anything external." Space followed suit. Quote, "Absolute space, in its own nature, without regard to anything external, remains always similar and immovable." End quote. Although other scientists contemporary with Newton notably Leibniz and Hooke, disagreed with this assessment. His enormous prestige eventually endowed his idea with the rigidity of dogma, despite the fact that these ideas were wrong. The medieval misconception that the earth was at rest and at center of the world was replaced with an equally problematic misconception regarding the absolute nature of space, time, and rest. Newton's disagreement with Huygens concerning the nature of light was the beginning of the wave-particle dilemma alluded to in Chapter 1. Newton's belief in corpuscular light stood in sharp contrast to Huygens' light waves undulating through the ether as water waves break upon a shore. Although publicly adhering to this published notion, Newton privately was troubled by light's seemingly dual nature. The issue appeared to be resolved a century later in 1801, when Thomas Young argued conclusively that light behaved as a wave. Young's incontrovertible evidence was his demonstration of the interference pattern of light. Targets and alternating bands of light and dark are interference patterns that are signature of waves. After initial resistance to the work that refuted the indisputable Newton, other scientists hailed Young's light as a wave as a major scientific discovery it was. Newton, Huygens, and Young are featured prominently in any discussion of optics. However, science historians usually skip over the discovery of Francesco Grimaldi. This post-Renaissance painter noted in 1665 that in the shadow surrounding an opaque object, there lies a thin layer of interference fringes. Disagreeing with the positions of Galileo and Newton, Grimaldi proposed that wave was not a stream of particles, but rather a fluid-like substance that could flow around objects. He surmised the fringes he observed were the ripples from the flow. While he did not formulate his findings in the tight mathematical language of science, this artist did, nevertheless, propose that light behaved like a wave 13 years before Huygens' 1678 wave theory. Newton's mistake pale before his accomplishments, and he emerges as a colossal figure who instituted a new way to think about the world. His Principia controverted the authority of the Bible. By the early 1700s, the majestic clockwork replaced the image of a white-bearded god on a heavenly throne. Philosophers, theologians, influenced by physicists such as Newton, compared the universe to a huge, mechanized ticking clock set in motion by the deity. After God made his timepiece and the laws that govern its functions, he retreated to observe his creation unconcernedly. Time, according to the scheme, flowed inexorably at a constant rate through a uniform and homogeneous space. Light was a mysterious essence that traveled from here to there like a speedy errand boy. The success of this metaphor led thinkers to exalt the strung beads of causality which were conveniently linked by the great chain of being. Another dominant metaphor extolling the virtues of determinism later in the 18th century. In the preceding chapters, the physical description of the world put forth by physicists were paired with an antecedent artist's vision. In these comparisons, we have seen that the artist presented society with a new way to see the world before a scientist discovered a new way to think about the world. But what artist's sensibility could possibly have anticipated the towering, solitary genius of Isaac Newton? Only one in all of Western civilization, Leonardo da Vinci. Although Leonardo was the outstanding figure of the 15th century and Newton's genius illuminated the 17th, there are many close parallels in the lives, thoughts, natures, beliefs, and accomplishments of these men. Newton was born a few months after his illiterate farmer father's death. When his mother soon remarried, Newton was sent away to be raised by his grandmother. As a child, he had to compete with a stepfather for his mother's affection. Leonardo was the illegitimate child of an illiterate peasant woman. Like Newton, he was initially raised by his mother without a father. Then, before the age of 5, he was also separated from his mother and brought into the household of his father, a Florentine lawyer of means who apparently didn't care much for the young Leonardo. Both Newton and Leonardo had few friends during childhood and both developed highly sensitive, dreamy natures. Each enjoyed his solitude and treasured his books above friendship. When Newton later in life was pressed by Edmund Halley to publish his discovery of the calculus, he felt concerned that publication would bring fame that might erode his privacy. He wrote in a letter, quote, "I see not what there is desirable in public esteem, were I able to acquire and maintain it. It would perhaps increase my acquaintance, the thing which I chiefly study to decline." End quote. 200 years earlier, Leonardo, echoing a similar statement, had written, quote, "If you are alone, you belong entirely to yourself. If you are accompanied by even one companion, you belong only half to yourself, or even less, in proportion to the thoughtlessness of his conduct. And if you have more than one companion, you will fall more deeply into the same plight." End quote. As young men, both Newton and Leonardo had a penchant for exotic practical jokes. Young Newton alarmed the Lincolnshire populace of one summer night by launching a hot air flying saucer that he constructed by attaching candles to a wooden frame beneath a wax paper canopy. Leonardo, using a connecting tube, once attached some bellows to the shriveled, dried intestines of a bull and placed the guts in one room while he stood with the bellow in another. When people arrived in the room, they barely noticed the prune-like coils, but were soon discomfited, and then stupefied as a huge balloon suddenly started to fill the available space, crowding them against the opposite wall. Both Leonardo and Newton had fecund imaginations from which poured forth a stream of discoveries, gadgets, engineering marvels, and far-sighted contrivances. Newton invented the reflecting telescope, Leonardo, the helicopter, Newton, the binomial theorem, Leonardo, the parachute, submarine, and tank. Newton's discoveries were expressed in equations, Leonardo's in drawings. Leonardo made many contributions to science, both in theory and application, but he is principally featured in art history classes. Newton wrote lengthy exegesis on alchemy, the mysteries of the Trinity, and the authority of the Bible, yet he is considered history's premier physicist. Both believed in pure mathematics as the highest expression of the human mind. Leonardo stated, "There is no certainty where one can neither apply any of the mathematical sciences, nor any of those which are based upon mathematical sciences." Newton, in the introduction to his Principia, wrote, quote, "I offer this work as the mathematical principle of philosophy, for the whole burden of philosophy seems to consist in this." End quote. Both rejected the Trinitarian dogma of Christian theology, believing instead in one God, and neither could express his true beliefs because in their repressive times, men and women were still hanged upon the gallows or burned at the stake for harboring such heresies. Each man transformed the science of his day from one that held an essentially static view of the universe into one that included motion. The subject of motion consumed them both, and their greatest contributions to humankind grew out of intense curiosity about it. Newton's ambitious desire to explain celestial movements resulted in the formulation of his three famous laws of motion and his discovery of the inverse square law of gravitation. Leonardo's compelling studies of the muscular movements and men and horses, exemplified in his cartoons for his Battle of Anghiari, are the most detailed anatomical descriptions of men and animals in motion that have ever been produced. He published a book that still remains the definitive study of equine anatomy. His interest in the principles of movement carried him far into the fields of anatomy, so that his contributions to this field of knowledge changed forever the way future students of this subject would be taught. The first modern medical textbook, Andreas Vesalius, De Humani Corposi Fabrica, published in 1543, owes an enormous debt to Leonardo's earlier anatomical studies. Leonardo also attempted to understand the concept of inertia and came astonishingly close to the central clue that allowed Newton to elaborate his laws of motion 2 centuries later. Leonardo wrote, quote, "Nothing whatever can be moved by itself, but its motion is affected through another. There is no other force." End quote. Elsewhere he proposes, quote, All movement tends to maintain, or rather all moved bodies continue to move as long as the impression of the force of their motor's original impetus remains in them. End quote. Newton's great first law of motion states, quote, every body continues in its state of rest, or of uniform motion in a straight line, unless it is compelled to change that state by forces impressed upon it. End quote. A comparison of these two statements explain why the principle of inertia was called the principle of Leonardo until Newton published his Principia. Thereafter, Newton was routinely granted credit for his discovery, which overturned a system of mathematics founded by Aristotle 2,000 years earlier. Parentheses. I have found very few references in scientific history books that acknowledge Leonardo's crucial observation 2 centuries before Newton. In parentheses. To Leonardo, quote, mechanics is the paradise of the mathematical science because, by means of it, one comes to the fruits of mathematics. End quote. Both Leonardo and Newton developed a code of laws to explain the physical universe. Leonardo, though, through seeing the world, Newton through thinking about it. Leonardo, the artist, analyzed the visual world with a scientific eye. In a sampling of his precepts, one finds, quote, when you have to draw from nature, stand 3 times as far away as the size of the objects that you are drawing. Every opaque object that is devoid of color partakes of the color of that which is opposite to it, as happens with a white wall. The shadows cast by trees on which the sun is shining are as dark as that of the center of the tree. The sun will appear greater in moving water, or when the surface is broken into waves, than it does in still water. End quote. Newton, the scientist, reduced the visual world to mathematical relationships, and yet was not satisfied with his formulations until he could make an easily visualizable geometrical model he could see. Oh, where did I leave off? He expressed this feeling when he wrote that it is the glory of geometry that from those few principles brought from without, it is able to produce so many things. Therefore, geometry is founded in mechanical practice. End quote. Both men were pioneers in the study of light, and both rebelled revolutionary insights about its nature. Revealed. Leonardo understood that images were reversed upon the retina. He is generally credited with the invention of the camera obscura, upon which the principle of modern photography rests. He studied optical illusions, and his explanations for them are still applied today. He sketched an instrument to record the intensity of light that differed from the little one developed by Benjamin Thompson, an American, 3 centuries later. Leonardo was also fascinated by shadows and worked out the geometrical details of the umbra and the penumbra that are still in use by present-day astronomers. He was familiar with eyeglasses and suggested in the 15th century the possibility of contact lenses. He investigated the phenomenon of the iridescence of peacock feathers and oil on water. He was the first person in the historical record to make the all-important surmise that light traveled through space and time as a wave. Extrapolating from water waves and sound waves, he wrote, quote, just as a stone thrown into water becomes the center and cause of various circles, sound spreads in circles in the air. Thus, every body placed in the luminous air spreads out in circles and fills the surrounding space with infinite likeness of itself and appears all in all and all in every part. End quote. Leonardo, the most visual of scientists, waxed poetic when describing the sense of sight by which we perceive light. Quote, the eye, which is the window of the soul, is the chief organ whereby the understanding can have the most complete and magnificent view of the infinite works of nature. Now do you not see that the eye embraces the beauty of the whole world? It counsels and corrects all of the art of mankind. It is the prince of mathematics, and the science founded on it are absolutely certain. He has measured the distances and sizes of the stars. He has discovered the elements and their location. He has given birth to architecture and to perspective as the divine art of painting. Oh, excellent thing, superior to all others created by God. What praises can do justice to your nobility? What people, what tongues will fully describe your function? The eye is the window of the human body through which it feels its way and enjoys the beauty of the world. Owing to the eye, the soul is content to stay in its bodily prison, for without it, such bodily prison is torture. O marvelous, O stupendous necessity, thou with supreme reason compellest all effect to be the direst result of their causes, and by a supreme and irrevocable law every nature, action, obeys thee by the shortest process possible. Who would believe that so small a space would contain all the images of the universe? End quote. With most enduring contributions to our knowledge of light were not written in words, however, but rather they can be seen in his paintings. Leonardo was able to coax out of brush and paint a rare quality of light. No artist before or since has achieved the mysterious opalescence of the distant atmosphere. His ineffable vistas of faraway mountains, the wordless interplay of ethereal light upon a woman's smile, the rippling fasciculations of a horse in a motion, are all bathed in a light that at once is representative of the visual world, and at the same time contains a sfumato that gives his work an almost otherworldly quality. Newton, on the other hand, wrote the definitive treatise on light when he published in 1704 his Optics. Typically, he was not as interested in seeing the effects of light as he was in understanding its nature. By passing sunlight through a series of prisms in a darkened room, he made discoveries that build upon the scientific inquiries that began with Leonardo. Newton went much further and explained how white sunlight can be broken down into different colors by refraction. Before Leonardo and Newton, alchemy had been the repository of European knowledge about optics. However, alchemists always resorted to spiritual terms to explain the prism's rainbow phenomenon. Newton repeatedly worked out with mathematical precision what Leonardo had expressed in concise drawings. Despite Newton's inventiveness, Leonardo was the more fecund of the two. I suspect his technical innovations and scientific discoveries are not appropriately acknowledged by science historians because Leonardo was so ahead of his time. His imagination so far outstripped the technology of the 15th century that many of his most brilliant inventions and theories could not even be tested. Nonetheless, Newton and Leonardo both traveled in the rarefied atmosphere of the brain's highest function, abstraction. Newton's invention of the calculus demanded the most difficult level of abstract thinking from those who attempted to follow him. Leonardo was similarly interested in abstract designs. In his Treatise on Painting, not published until 1651, he spoke of a method of, quote, quickening the spirit of invention, end quote. He advised the artist, quote, you should look at certain walls stained with damp or at stones of uneven color. If you have to invent some backgrounds, you will be able to see in these the likeness of divine landscapes, adorned with mountains, ruins, rocks, woods, great plains, hills, and valleys in great variety, an expression of faces and clothes, and an infinity of things that you will be able to reduce to their complete and proper forms. In such walls, the same things happen as in the sound of bells, in whose stroke you may find every named word which you can imagine. End quote. Leonardo's interest in images without things led him to the first European artist to draw a landscape. In doing so, he took the important step away from concrete and symbolic representation toward abstraction. Pure landscapes were utterly unimaginable to Greek, Roman, and Christian artists because they do not include the usual hierarchy of man-made things or people. Instead, they are the beginning of a recognition of pattern rather than objects. His interest in abstract pattern intensified until Leonardo became preoccupied with pure geometrical design. His notebooks are filled with pictures that have finally no identifiable image. Later in Leonardo's life, he did many drawings of his eruption of the deluge, 1514, that second coming of the flood, purifying with water the sins of humankind. In these drawings, the complex shapes of massive walls of falling water achieve a level of art without an image that anticipated by 400 years that the abstract works of Vasily Kandinsky, Kazimir Malevich, and Piet Mondrian. Both men were prolific writers who wrote about many subjects, though neither published the bulk of his published writings during his lifetime. John Maynard Keynes, whose fame as an economist eclipsed his lifelong study of Newton, purchased at auction the remains of a trunk into which Newton had stuffed his writings on matters non-scientific. Keynes estimated the upwards of 1 million words in handwriting still survive, and go on to classify the material. Quote, all his unpublished works on esoteric and theological matters are marked by careful learning, accurate method, and extreme sobriety of statement. They are just as sane as the Principia, if their whole matter and purpose were not magical. They were nearly all composed during the same 25 years of his mathematical studies. They fall into several groups. Very early in life, Newton abandoned orthodox belief in the Trinity. He arrived at the conclusion not on, so to speak, rational or skeptical grounds, but entirely on the interpretation of ancient authority. He was persuaded that the revealed documents give no support to the Trinitarian doctrines, which were due to the late falsifications. The revealed God was one God. Another large section is concerned with all branches of apocalyptic writings from which he sought to deduce the secret truths of the universe. The measurements of Solomon's temple, the Book of David, the Book of Revelations, an enormous volume of works of which some part was published in his later days. A large section, judging by the handwriting amongst the earliest, relates to alchemy, transmutation, the Philosopher's Stone, the Elixir of Life. The scope and character of these papers have been hushed up, or at least minimized, by nearly all those who have inspected them. Newton was clearly an unbridled addict, and it is utterly impossible to deny that it is wholly magical and wholly devoid of scientific value, and also impossible to admit that Newton devoted years to working on it. End quote. Although Leonardo never published a single book, his writings were as extensive. The scattered and uncollated pages of notes left behind were indexed somewhat haphazardly over the ensuing centuries, resulting in the Codex Atlanticus, which contains 1,222 pages bundled together, evidently not in the order Leonardo wrote them. In these pages are some of the most astonishing revelations of the Renaissance, most incisive mind. In one line, Leonardo states with conviction, quote, the sun does not move, end quote, thereby anticipating both Copernicus and Galileo. The many pages of notes included an astonishing array of drawings of aerial maps, swirling water, plants, grand irrigation schemes, anatomical studies, and the ever-present profiles of faces of every physiognomic variation. In addition to the other parallels, as an interesting aside, both of these titanic figures had to contend with a rival of almost equal stature. In the case of Newton, it was the German mathematician Gottfried Wilhelm von Leibniz. For Leonardo, it was Michelangelo. The living presence of intellect that could challenge Newton and Leonardo's led, as one would expect, to confrontation with their respective foils. Leibniz had a chance to see Newton's notes concerning the calculus by means of a third party in 1676. Using Newton's equations, he claimed to have invented the calculus independently, and when he published his method, the German intellectuals were quite proud that one of their own had made such a significant contribution to human thought. Edmund Halley, an Englishman, was aware that Newton had discovered his fluxions, which is what Newton had called his calculus, 20 years earlier, but had failed to share them with anyone else because of his secretive nature. Concerned about the claim of primacy, Halley made a patriotic appeal to Newton and urged him to come forward to receive his honor. Newton detested Leibniz and has finally unveiled his calculus by publishing it in the Proceedings of the Royal Society. He then wrote letters to the society under assumed names, impugning Leibniz's honor and advancing his own claim of primacy to the discovery of calculus. Newton had hid behind another scientist, John Keel, surreptitiously instructing him how to question Leibniz's integrity. On one occasion, Newton suggested to Keel which exact phrases to use and then added, compare them with your own sentiments and then draw up such an answer as you think proper. You need not set your name to it. Thus, by character assassination and subterfuge, Newton persisted until the Royal Society properly accorded him with the official honor of discovering this much-valued mathematical tool, even though Leibniz published first. Leonardo's confrontation with Michelangelo is equally revealing about how different Leonardo's character was from Newton's. According to Vasari, Leonardo and Michelangelo strongly disliked each other. Leonardo, who enjoyed dressing immaculately and wearing the latest fashions, had frequently made snide comments about the coarse and peasant-like appearance Michelangelo presented in his sculptor's working clothes and his ever-present male patina of marble dust. Michelangelo had heard of Leonardo's remarks and did not endear the painter to him. When Michelangelo learned that the Duke of Sforza, the ruler of Milan, had commissioned Leonardo to cast an equestrian statue, he sneered contemptuously, believing that the dilettante painter could never bring such a project to completion. Leonardo, of course, was up to the task. There had been many man-on-a-horse monuments when Leonardo was determined to create something that likes of which the world had never seen. He set out to create an object not only of great beauty, but also the largest, most daring equestrian statue ever conceived. When Leonardo finished making a model in plaster, it was so magnificent that the townspeople urged him to place it outside in the piazza for all to behold in the sunshine. Meanwhile, the artist busied himself with the engineering details of the proposed casting and informed his patron Sforza he would need 200,000 pounds of bronze. Sforza dutifully began to accumulate such a staggering quantity of the expensive metal, but not without a nagging doubt about the wisdom of commissioning such a large and expensive statue. Shortly thereafter, Sforza found himself pressed by the armies of the French at his gate. He diverted the bronze he had put aside for Leonardo's statue and directed that to be cast into cannons instead. Depressed, Leonardo prudently departed for Florence. The horse suffered the fate of the martyrdom in St. Sebastian when the French mercenaries forced the gates. They were confronted by the piazza, deserted save for a towering clay horse, which must have appeared to them as a Trojan horse in reverse. In the victory celebration that followed, drunken soldiers began shooting arrows at the vulnerable cavallo and continued to do so into the night. In the morning, the arrows were removed, and the mortally wounded horse was exposed to the elements. Rainwater seeped into the arrow's tracks, and within a month, the erosive effect caused the horse to disintegrate. One day soon after Florence, Leonardo passed a group of young men in the piazza who were discussing Dante's Inferno. They asked Leonardo for his interpretation, just as Michelangelo, who was also living in Florence, deep in thought, rounded the corner. Michelangelo was known to have studied Dante zealously. Leonardo, in a gentlemanly fashion, said, "Here's Michelangelo. Let's ask him, and he will know." Michelangelo, however, misunderstood and thought Leonardo was making fun of him. Michelangelo exploded, quote, "Explain them yourselves. You made a design for a horse to be cast in bronze, and unable to cast it. You have in your shame abandoned it. And to think that those Milanese capons believed you." End quote. Leonardo flushed deeply, but made no reply, turned on his heels, and strode away. These two titans never spoke to each other again, but Leonardo, as best we know, never disparaged or wrote ill of Michelangelo. Newton, on the other hand, continued to malign Leibniz, even after his enemy had died. In the voluminous writing of both men, personal statements are curiously absent. Upon learning of his father's death, for example, Leonardo made the following dispassionate entry in his journal. Quote, "On the 9th of July, 1504, Wednesday at 7 o'clock, died San Piero da Vinci, notary at the Palace of the Podesta, my father, at 7 o'clock. He was 80 years old, left 10 sons and 2 daughters." End quote. Newton, likewise, tells us almost nothing about the seething passions that might lie beneath the granite-like exterior. His quarrels with Hooke, Flamsteed, and Leibniz provide indirect insights into his nature, but of his own thoughts, he offers very little. These solitary geniuses shared a penchant for secrecy and loved to decode and write in cryptograms. In correspondence with Leibniz, Newton enshrouded his calculus in a cryptogram, During the time that he formulated the laws that guided our understanding of celestial mechanics, he was immersed in trying to decipher the cryptic verses of ancient alchemists. Leonardo, whose handwriting was barely decipherable, also engaged in writing in code and enjoyed trying to decipher occult messages from the past. In some ways, of course, Leonardo and Newton were entirely unlike. On one hand, Newton was a caricature of a one-sided scientific genius. Aldous Huxley wrote that, as a man, he was a failure. As a monster, he was superb. Later in his life, when Newton became head of the Mint, he seemed to take an inordinate pleasure in interrogating counterfeiters and attended their hangings with a ghoulish, avid interest. His attitudes toward the leavening aspects of life were bleak. Timothy Ferris wrote that Newton turned a deaf ear to music, dismissed great work of sculpture as stone dolls, and viewed poetry as kind of ingenious nonsense. Leonardo, on the other hand, was the exemplary Renaissance man. By reputation, he was a gentle and generous, and although he was a solitary man, he was an accomplished musician and a pleasant, witty conversationalist. Leonardo developed a philosophy akin to that of St. Francis of Assisi. He had a reverence for all living things and frequently bought caged birds just so he could set them free. He became a vegetarian because he did not believe one should ever kill a living creature. It is a paradox without parallel in Newton's life that Leonardo, who was reputed to be unable to harm a fly, developed a peculiar detachment toward his engines of war. In the course of his career, he invented the most gruesome devices to grind and rend the flesh of an enemy soldiers. Without the faintest moral compunction, he solicited employment from the infamous Caesar Borgia and left his post as Borgia's military engineer only when he discovered that a fellow worker of his, also in Borgia's employ, had been strangled to death for some unknown reason by their mutual patron. It is probable that historians have failed to pair these two geniuses because we learn history as a record of accomplishment. Newton's legacy completely altered the way Western civilization thought about the world, while Leonardo's has been called a genius who did not leave the posterity any idea that changed the way we think. But that sort of criticism misses the point. Using both brush and pen, Leonardo changed the way we see the world, and this subtle shift in mindset prepared people to be receptive when Newton introduced a new way to think about the world. Once again, the artist's revelation preceded the physicist's. In one of Newton's most famous statements, he deferred to the scientists who preceded him. "If I have seen further than other men, it is because I stood on the shoulder of giants." End quote. Traditionally, these other giants were thought to be Copernicus, Descartes, Galileo, and Kepler. To this illustrious group, I would add Leonardo. And that is chapter 6. I hope you excuse all of the interruptions that I have faced today, this morning, and the unusual way that I recorded this podcast. Usually I haven't had the need to pause or to read at different times, but today it seemed as though I did. If you do listen, please, if you reach out and tell me how you thought or felt about this episode, this chapter, I'd be greatly appreciative of your efforts. Was it better? Was it worse? Was it confusing? Was it distracting? Whatever it was, I hope you enjoyed some of the reading. Maybe enough to get a book yourself and stop listening to me and read it for your own, from your own home and for your own brain and at your own pace and at your own, with your own voice. But if you did enjoy it, I will be reading chapter 7 at some point in the future. And perhaps before I leave you, I will leave a quote from the next chapter by William Blake. Quote, "Art degraded, imagination denied." And one by Immanuel Kant, a great philosopher. Quote, "Although all knowledge begins with experience, it does not necessarily all spring from experience." Because next chapter, chapter 7, will be on rationality and irrationality. Hope to see you then. Have a great day.